Let me just make a special point to thank Rachel Bonnet, good morning. Susan Orwood, I don't see Susan.
Oh, there you are.
And Helen, of course, Dale Rosenborn, Ian, but really lots and lots of people made this event happen, and I just want to thank all of them for making it happen. I also want to introduce somebody who's really relatively new to this area. That's Shari Raven. And Shari is the new professor of Jewish Studies at the College of Charleston. She's the assistant director of the Center for Southern Jewish Culture, the Bernstein Lipov Center for Southern Jewish Culture, which really, in many ways, will really mark yet another new beginning, really a very good beginning for the Jewish Historical Society of South Carolina, since the Jewish Historical Society of South Carolina has been critical in getting people interested in Southern Jewish history, and the Pearlstein Lipov families involved with Southern Jewish history. So it's an honor to have Shari here. She moved to Charleston from Brooklyn, so that's something of a culture shock. And she just finished a PhD in Yale, at Yale in Religious Studies, and her field was on Jewish migration and, in fact, its impact on American Jewish history. And it's a joy to have her. She's really, if you want anyone to cheer her on, ask Dale. Dale has just been a big cheerleader for her. I'd like to also thank Historic Columbia, by the way, for their partnership in making this happen. That partnership has been an enormous success, and I will make a few remarks immediately afterwards, after I speak. I thank Richard Gerlach and Greenwald for their help in getting the Big Apple underway. We'll meet there for the reception and for our meeting tomorrow. And a shuttle will be provided by the City Center Partnership, and that will run from the Marriott to the Big Apple from 5 to 6:30. We found out that Hillary Clinton will be at the Marriott between 5 and 6:30, so the shuttle might come close to the Marriott and probably won't get very close. So the way this will work is today we'll have a presentation, we'll then have a panel. We will then have a walking tour of historic Columbia, the emergence of Columbia, and then we'll have a reception at the Big Apple. Tomorrow we will have our business meeting here, and then we'll go to Orangeburg. Here we go, Columbia, from Charleston. Here we go, the Big Apple, and then we'll go over to Orangeburg, visit the cemetery, place an historic mark, and then have a panel. So, just for those of you who are new to the Jewish Historical Society of South Carolina, it really began over 20 years ago now, when Izzy Mooney in particular had an interest in the decline of small town Jewish life in South Carolina. When places like Orangeburg had vibrant Jewish communities, I mean small but vibrant, and the reality of Jewish life really made those communities begin to disappear. So Orangeburg is an example of that. It's a wonderful small community, but its Jewish community is really sort of, I think, to say it's on the decline might be a euphemism, because it really has, in many ways, declined. So we want to celebrate its history and let posterity know that, in fact, there once was a very, very important Jewish community in downtown Orangeburg. I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce Robin Waits, who will make a few remarks.
I know y'all are really here to see Belinda and Richard, so I'm happy to. I joined the staff of Historic Columbia in 2002 and took over as the executive director in 2004, and my first board president was Lynn Gerbel. with my parents, knew her, and worked with her there. But it wasn't until I became her staff person, really, at Historic Columbia that I came to really appreciate the wonderful, brilliant, vibrant woman, energetic woman that she is. And for our organization, I think really the seeds of the Columbia Jewish Heritage Initiative that we kind of kicked off about a year and a half ago really were started when Belinda joined our organization. She called for a Historic Columbia that told stories that were more inclusive of the community, that really reached beyond kind of the walls of the buildings that we managed as house museums and got into the community and invited other people to tell us their own stories. She really kind of brought to the table something that we hadn't had before, and certainly telling the stories of the Jewish community was a part of that. And so I'm thankful for the opportunity to work with her, and you people in Charleston who have her now, we want her back one day. We've also had the pleasure of having Susan Brill as a past president of Historic Columbia, also bring some of that same energy and vision to the table, and loved having Susan and all of her great connections with city and county governments that helped take the organization from a financial perspective in a very different direction than her. Susan was instrumental in getting the HTAX passed, which helped us really be who we are today. So these are wonderful women who you are lucky to have among your peers. The Columbia Jewish Heritage Initiative is this multi-discipline project that the goal of which is to document as well as provide access to an awareness of local Jewish history. So the coalition really of that forms the Columbia Jewish Heritage Initiative includes the College of Charleston's Jewish Heritage Collection. Dale and Alyssa have really been instrumental in that partnership. The Jewish Community Center and the Columbia Jewish Federation, Barry Abels and Cheryl Nail, have been great to work with as well. The Jewish Historical Society of South Carolina, of course, partnering with this group has been really wonderful. Rachel has pulled us into that as if we were family, and it's been great. Richland Library, I don't know if Debbie is here, but she's happy. And then, of course, Historic Columbia is the other partner. And I've got several staff who are here today, Wendy Surratt, John Shear, Robert Olby, and Dixon Monk, who all play different roles in helping make this happen. So in April of 2014, the leadership of the Jewish Community Center and the Columbia Jewish Federation, really led by Debbie Cohn, who you'll meet if you haven't already a little bit later this afternoon. Debbie's really the brainchild that made this happen. They were really interested in expanding an existing community-based initiative that we have that was called Connecting Communities Through History, which is looking thematically at the Jewish community. So in response to that initial inquiry, Historic Columbia and the JCC invited representatives from various states and local organizations that support these kinds of initiatives. And we had that first meeting. Steve Sattis was with us at that first meeting. Keith Backhoff was with us at. And really, those initial gatherings led to the following. There's a generation of Jews who experienced the Holocaust that's rapidly diminishing, and many stories of survivors who settled in Columbia had not been documented. And the second was that while Columbia enjoys a very long and rich history of Jewish settlement, there is little access to and awareness of the impact of this group locally. So these initial sessions really led to the formation of the Columbia Jewish Heritage Initiative. We've got a steering committee that's in place, folks like Lily Filler, like Gail Lee. Gail is here. Rachel and Debbie are part of that group. And we had the goal really of addressing these activities, identify the gaps in documentation, much of which Richard and Belinda are going to have done so much work that they're not a lot of gaps that are there. We're finding the ways that we can add to that story. To develop a forum for dialogue that's catalyzed by the collection and sharing of stories, and to really harness the potential of a variety of print, web-based, and programmatic platforms to share this information, and then to codify the coalition that was established in April of 2014. So we had some wonderful early support for this project, and I don't think that Ray Luce is here, but he was with us this morning, and hopefully will be with us later on this afternoon, but he made a personal contribution to the project to get us started. Dale and Alyssa kind of took our volunteers in, trained them to do interviews. Lily and Jane Colbert, Barbara Blau, and Gail Lee. And they've been collecting stories that will be accessible through the Low Country Digital Archive. So we're very thankful for that access. So following that initial kind of push from Ray, in May, the Central Carolina Community Foundation awarded Historic Columbia a $20,000 grant specifically for this effort. They're interested in projects that would promote a more engaged, compassionate, and connected community by focusing on vibrant social offerings, superb public spaces, and a welcoming community. And we were able to take that first $20,000 gift and leverage support from the Columbia Jewish Federation, Southern Jewish Historical Society, Humanities Council of South Carolina. And in August, the City of Columbia supported the effort with a $50,000 grant. So to date, we've raised close to $90,000 just for this initiative. We're really kind of considering this partnership our kickoff weekend for the effort. Robert and John have been working tirelessly on the walking tour that I hope many of you will enjoy this afternoon. We're also going to offer it tomorrow, and again, it's a happy hour history tour on November 20th. The young adult division at the JCC in Columbia is training to lead those happy hour history tours, so we're trying to get really an intergenerational group involved here. Heidi Love is put on a fabulous Jewish film festival, and we are sponsoring 24 Days, which will play tomorrow at 7:30 with a talk back following that. We're going to have a presence at Bubby's for Six on November the 22nd. We are going to invite you and others who attend to bring photographs and stories of your Bubby to share with us. We'll have a scanner there so we can collect those and record. And again, this is Debbie's wonderful grandchild. And on December 2nd, gosh, Debbie, I think you should be up here. Debbie and Rick are hosting an evening, a piano concert at their home with Solomon Heitner, whose grandparents were Holocaust survivors. That should be wonderful. And there's some brochures on your table, flyers on your table that have a little bit of information about each of these. So we'll continue over the next 6 months and beyond to collect stories, but we've really got this goal in May to have a guided walking and driving tour, a web-based tour, three historic markers, and a series of school-based travel and trunk programs that integrate the Jewish story into the larger story of Columbia's history. I mentioned a few folks who are volunteering with the effort. Susan has been with us on the development committee as well. We'd love to have you involved. So we've got lots of great committees. We are looking for folks who want to be interviewed as well as people who want to interview them. We're always looking for contributions to help us do more with the effort. And again, the flyer on the table, we would love for you to participate in the programs as we move forward. We've got a great Facebook page, we've got a website. I invite you to check those out under Historic Columbia Jewish Columbia Heritage Initiative. And without further ado, I'll let someone come up and introduce your fabulous 1 o'clock speaker.
Good afternoon. I'm Jeff Rosenblum, past president. As I look out here today, I see a lot of familiar faces, and I say hi to y'all, and some new faces. Welcome. It's encouraging to see all the new people here today as well. I have the honor of introducing our speakers for this afternoon. I've known our speakers since 1984 when we went to Israel together. And over the years since then, we've become closer and closer friends, and it's really an honor for me to do this. Our keynote speaker really needs no introduction. Richard and Belinda Gergel are both past presidents of the Jewish Historical Society and have been staunch supporters from the Society's inception. Richard and Belinda have both respectfully served their communities and countries. Linda served on the Columbia City Council and as a board president for Historic Columbia before departing for the Holy City. Hence the Tale of Two Cities, the topic of this meeting. What we fail sometimes to say is that Richard really developed his life here as a practicing attorney and Belinda as a professor at the College of Columbia. In December 2009, Richard was nominated by the President Obama to serve on the United States District Court for the District of South Carolina and was confirmed by the United States Senate on August 5, 2010 and received commission on August 9, 2010. They are the authors of In Pursuit of the Tree of Life, a History of the Early Jews of Columbia, and the Tree of Life Congregation. They are with us today to discuss the early Jews of Columbia. Please join me in welcoming our friends, the judge and the doctor.
To sort of jump in front of my husband But I'm going to sort of set the stage for you for just a second. Is that right now? Is that? Wow.
We may talk longer.
We may talk longer. Okay. So get comfortable. Okay. Richard's going to start our presentation off today, giving us the backdrop for considering the Jewish story in Columbia. And he's going to bring us up to the founding of the city. That'll be about 4 hours. And then I'm going to jump in and talk about the first real decades of Jewish life in Columbia. And then we'll back up to Richard a little bit more. We're going to finish around the time of the Civil War. Okay? So get comfortable. Here we go.
Linda reminded me that it's been 20 years that we have been on this journey. It feels like sometimes it's been longer and sometimes much shorter. But we must have given, I don't know, are we now not picking me up as well? We have given talks to people who are very familiar with Jewish history or Columbia history, and we have given talks to people wholly unfamiliar with the history. And some seem to have been amazed there are Jews in South Carolina. That was the first one, right? Marty, you've heard this one. And then they say, oh, I think there are Jews in Charleston, but nowhere else, right? And the Jews didn't know how to get out of Charleston. And I got to tell you, when we began this journey on this story, we learned a lot and unfolded a lot that none of us knew, and it was really, in the end, a quite remarkable story. But one of the things that I'm frequently asked, how did the Jews get to Columbia? What's that all about? You know, we think about Jews going to port cities and that type of thing, and there certainly were vibrant Jewish communities in Charleston and Mobile and Philadelphia, etc. But how did they get to Columbia? That doesn't really fit the profile. Well, I think you got to step back just for a second to have context. And it's really stepping back several centuries, because the story really begins unfolding with the Spanish and Portuguese Inquisition and Sephardic Jews being basically exiled from what had been an incredible place for Jews. The whole Iberian Peninsula had been remarkable. And Jews ended up in Amsterdam and in London. Some went to North Africa. Some went to Eastern Europe. But they were really a displaced people. And they were ambitious and well-educated people. They were great traders. And as the New World opened, many Jews sought for an opportunity to come to the West Indies and eventually to the new colony of Carolina. Because one of the things that didn't exist in the New World to the extent it did in really the Old World was the dominance of the established church. And in many of those countries, the established of the Catholic Church. Where Jews felt very, very marginalized, very isolated. There was a lot of anti-Semitism. And it was a difficult situation. So the idea was the New World was in many ways a source of great opportunity for Jews. And they went throughout the West Indies. Barbados was one of the islands they went to, another West Indian, Jamaica, etc. And then when Charleston began, 1660 is when the Carolina colony was created. Remember the story? There were 8 noblemen who had helped Charles II be restored to the crown. And Carolina was the reward for their efforts. And they didn't want to create a religious colony. Many of the early colonies were religious practices. Other dissenter religious groups seeking to run away from the established churches where they came. So you had Quakers in Pennsylvania, you had Catholics in Maryland, etc. But those were very much religious efforts, and they were very driven by the particular religious denomination dominating the colony. Carolina was different. It was a business enterprise. They wanted to bring people to this new land. But I'll tell you, it wasn't that attractive. Mosquitoes, angry Indians, there were just a lot of sort of, you know, this was not the most, there was yellow fever and malaria. Why would you come to this place? And they were trying to market themselves as a place that
that people would want to come from away. And one of the group things they figured out was there were a lot of religious dissenters out there who were persecuted in their home countries. And if we could persuade the dissenters to come to Carolina, that might provide us settlers. And religious dissenters were a pretty attractive lot. They were devoted people. They tended to be family. They were faith-based. Those were kind of desirable colonies. And so Lord Salisbury was the managing partner of this of these noblemen, these lord proprietors, and they had a secretary. It was a little business enterprise who ran the enterprise, and he was John Locke. He wasn't John Locke as we think today, because the most famous one of the most the great political thinkers of his era. He was a young man. And he had this idea about that one of the keys to freedom was religious freedom. And his first really major document was something called the Fundamental Constitution of Carolina. And it provided the first constitution for the Carolina colony. And it provided for religious freedom. It was the first constitution in human history to provide for religious freedom. And it explicitly referenced, it says it includes the rights of in the Constitution protected heathens, Jews, and other dissenters. My friend Robert Rosen said, we immediately made the top three, you know. And we were one of the heathens, the Jews, and the other dissenters. But it was, the explicit mention of the Jews really kind of got people's attention, that this was for real. And the Constitution provided that any seven people forming together could organize their own church. Well, they came from countries where there was only one church, and you couldn't organize a competing church. Here they were, they said any seven could form their own church, and it made it a violation of the Constitution to disturb a religious gathering or to revile another's religion. And it was clearly aimed, some believe, aimed directly at the very prosperous Jewish community of Barbados. There were 10% of the population of Barbados was Jewish. And there were a lot of problems in Barbados. There was a lot of wealth. And many of the early Jewish settlers were from Barbados. They came to Charleston. And their arrival, the first Jew is recorded in 1695. The colony is like formally organized in 1670. In 1695, we have the first Jews documented to be in the Carolina colony. And by 1697, four Jews are given citizenship in the Carolina colony. Now, why is that important? Well, in England, of course, Carolina is a British colony, Jews weren't citizens until 43 years later. You were being welcomed. You were a citizen. You were respected. You could do business. You could organize your synagogue. And sure enough, people began to arrive. And the word went back, this thing's for real. You could open businesses, you could trade, and very early on, the synagogue was organized, the Hall Kadosh Beth Elohim, the Holy Congregation of the House of God, what we now know as KKBE. And it is, as many of you know, the oldest continuously operated synagogue in the world. It was formed in Charleston. And Charleston also formed burial societies and charitable societies. It was an incredible, vibrant community. One historian has called Charleston, by the year 1800, the capital of Jewish America. More Jews lived in Charleston than any city in North America. 25% of all Jews in North America lived in South Carolina. One in four. And it wasn't just in Charleston. What happened was, and this is what leads us to the Columbia story, is that Jews began family, particularly they were like family members in business. They would go, and the Jews went to Georgetown, they went to Camden, they went to Sumter, they came to Columbia. The Salvador family, one of the great merchant families of England, bought several hundred thousand acres in the upstate of South Carolina. It was known as the Jews' Land of South Carolina. That was the name of that area near Greenwood. It was a huge area of land. In Francis Salvador, you'll see a marker which references Francis Salvador there. He was the nephew sent by the merchant family, the Salvador family, to South Carolina to manage the affairs and to manage this area. And Francis Salvador immediately gets caught up in revolutionary politics. He's kind of liked the idea of independence. I'm sure the family back home wasn't that excited with all that. They'd send him there to manage it. He's starting a revolution. But in 1774, he is elected to the first Provisional Congress of South Carolina, which is really the first revolutionary Congress that leads eventually to the separation from England. When Francis Salvador is elected, he is the first Jew in modern history elected to public office. First one anywhere. And then, he's reelected a year later in 1775. They start to have, shortly after the Declaration of Independence in July of 1776, there's an outbreak up in his area. He's killed, and he's 29 years old, and he is the first Jew to die for American freedom. So when you say that sort of the Jews were there from the start, the Jews were there from the beginning, really almost the beginning of Charleston, and they were there from the beginning as Jews moved in. And I'm just going to share the story a bit about the Jewish arrival in Columbia.
Well, it's impossible to know who the first Jewish citizens were in the Columbia area. But clearly, the early 1700s, mid-1700s, we've got lots of people moving inland from Charleston. In fact, if you were willing to move inland, you could pick up 50, 100, several hundred acres, depending on the size of your family, if you were willing to move in. Free land was offered. And so as we move through the 18th century, we see lots of folks moving to Columbia, to the Columbia area. As you know, this area is not a city until 1786. But we have numerous examples of people moving in the area, many of whom had Jewish-sounding last names. In 1786, the legislature moved the capital of South Carolina to Columbia from Charleston, to the banks of the Congaree River. And this was a planned city. It was laid out with streets, defined geographic borders, and really from the beginning of the decision to create Columbia as a state capital, to form a land commission to sell lots, we had a Jewish presence. Indeed, this is an advertisement from the Charleston paper announcing the sale of lots. The sale would take place. The auctioneer, Joseph Myers, a member of Charleston's KKBE synagogue congregation. And among those who purchased lots in the first offering of the sale were seven members of Charleston's Jewish community. So from day one, there's a Jewish engagement with the new city of Columbia. Jews began moving in, and we have an interesting set of characters who come. Among those were Judah and Jacob Barrett, and they came and opened a very early grocery store. They relocated from Charleston, and they sell a little bit of everything here in Columbia. The Barrett store sold dry goods, groceries, provisions, liquor, hardware, shoes, hats, and saddles. Just about everything you could need for a new state capital. Also coming up were Isaac Lyons, a German Jew who had first settled with his family in Philadelphia. then moved to Charleston, and then came on to Columbia, and they opened a grocery store on the corner of Main and Gervais. Back then, Main Street was called Richardson Street, but it's right there on the corner. I think Isaac Lyons represents a number of the folks who came bringing important ties to other communities, because Isaac Lyons brought strong ties not just to Charleston, but also to Philadelphia. Humphrey and Francis Marks arrived in the late 1820s with their grown children, and they opened the Marks, Porter, and Relish House. And here's an advertisement from the Columbia paper on that business. And you see liquors mentioned, of course, in any new town, particularly one that's just struggling. Folks are going to want to endeavor a little bit, but they also provided a reading room on the top floor, and they collected newspapers. It sort of functioned as an early reading library. And then we had folks, and you can barely see their names at the bottom, Levi Pollock and Phineas Solomon. And they represent some of those who came up from Charleston looking for new opportunities. Certainly, Levi Pollock had had problems. He'd been convicted of larceny, but pardoned if he left the state of South Carolina. So he left Charleston with that opportunity, but did resettle here in Columbia. They opened up an auction house. The business grew and prospered greatly, and soon both men had become leaders in Columbia's business community and in Columbia's Jewish community. They were early leaders and founding members of the Columbia Hebrew Benevolent Society. But it really was in the professions that Columbia's Jews exerted influence that far exceeded their small numbers. Chapman Levy, who lived both in Camden and in Columbia, was perhaps the city's first Jewish, we can't find any records indicating there was an earlier Jewish lawyer, but he is the city's first Jewish lawyer and certainly one of South Carolina's first. Chapman Levy came over in the 1820s. He operated a brickyard here in Columbia. He is a master duelist. He actually ran a school that would teach you how to, be a dueler. He is recognized all around South Carolina as one who knows how to teach you to become a good duelist. He was a member of the legislature representing Kershaw County in both the House and the Senate. In 1820, when the census was taken, he lived here in Columbia. And he is apparently the largest Jewish slave owner in America in 1820, with 20 slaves recorded in the census. He gained a lot of notoriety for prosecuting the brother of Governor John Taylor. And he and the governor's son ended up in a duel. He stayed here. It's believed, or certainly a number of historians have felt, that the Columbia Hebrew Benevolent Society likely is on land that Chapman Levy gave to become the cemetery, because his wife is one of the first buried there at the cemetery. In the area of elected office, we had several Jewish men step forward. Judah Barrett of the Barrett Store was elected to city council in 1827. In the 1830s, Mordecai Hendricks de Leon is elected as Columbia's intendant. That is what the position of mayor was called. De Leon and his family had moved up from Charleston. And he and his wife became very active in the life of the city. He's elected for three terms in the 1830s. And then we have Henry Lyons, the son of Isaac Lyons, who is elected to city council in the 1840s. And I've got a picture here which appears to be out of order. Here is Henry. There are several wonderful stories about Henry Lyons. But Henry Lyons is elected to city council in the 1840s. In 1850, he becomes Columbia's second Jewish mayor. Among the things that he is known for is the fabulous garden that he had in a city block home that's bordered by chickens and bull and lady and Gervais. And in that backyard, he is credited with introducing the clean peach to America. Clearly, though, one of the most interesting of those early presidents was Dr. Elias Marx, son of Humphrey and Francis. Dr. Marx had been trained as a physician in New York, and as early as 1817, he and his wife have committed their professional careers to women's higher education. He becomes the director of the Columbia Female Academy, which was run downtown. And he began active advocacy with the legislature for state-funded women's higher education. He then went, when the legislature refused to make such a funding appropriation, and opened the Barnumville Female Institute, South Carolina Collegiate Institute, out in near Barnumville Road. That's the whole section. That road takes its name for the school. And it became one of the most celebrated institutions for higher education for women before the Civil War. Among its graduates were Anna Pamela Cunningham, who helped to spearhead the effort to save Mount Vernon, and Martha Bullock, the mother of President Theodore Roosevelt. The community quickly began to organize for formal Jewish life in Columbia. As early as 1822, a burial society was in place. In 1826, the Columbia Hebrew Benevolent Society is established. It assumed the work of the burial society and also worked to take care of Jewish families in need in the area. In the 1840s, there is a formal effort to address the need for the Jewish education of Columbia's youth. And so we begin a wonderful story in the 1840s with the arrival of a young woman that I think truly set the stage for more organized Jewish life in our city. In 1843, young Joanna Wolfe from Philadelphia comes to Columbia to visit her sister, who is married to City Councilman Henry Lyons, later Mayor Henry Lyons. And while she's here, she's surprised to see that there's no formal effort underway to educate the Jewish children in Columbia. And so she begins to meet with leaders in the city. And she had been very active in Philadelphia with Rebecca Gratz and with others who had spearheaded the Jewish, at the time it was called the Jewish Sunday School Movement in America. The first effort to provide formal religious training, education to Jewish youth. And she wanted to see something like that here in Columbia. So she meets with leaders, and out of that, she gets their support in organizing what she called the Columbia, either Israelite Sunday School or Jewish Sunday School. The school opens, and the community is ecstatic about seeing their young children perform, learn the prayers, sing the songs and the chants. And so with that underway, folks began to talk about organizing a Jewish congregation and erecting a synagogue. In 1846, that synagogue is opened. It is called Sharef Israel, Remnant of Israel. And they had a part-time rabbi and a kosher butcher. I wanted to share with you, this is an announcement of the Sunday school that appeared in the only Jewish newspaper in the country in the 1840s, the Occident. And you see that the announcement about the Sunday School, Hebrew Sunday School of Columbia, mentioning those women involved in the teaching and in the activities to take place. And reports of the school were regularly published in the Occident. And now we have in the Occident the report of the congregation in Columbia that results ultimately in the organization of the synagogue. The synagogue was located across the street from the Richland County Public Library. And the downstairs housed the religious school, and the upstairs housed the synagogue, the congregation. That building was burned in the fire of 1865. It was destroyed. But the Benevolent Society provided the money for that building and the early support for that operation. In sum, Columbia's early Jewish community absolutely found a warm and receptive general environment in the city. They were welcomed. Jews were welcomed here. They provided skills that any new city would need, and they were good, good citizens. So for the most part, almost in toto, we have an incredibly exciting experience here. But there were some examples of anti-Semitism, and Richard's going to share two with you. Okay?
You notice the deal is, Lenny gets all the glory and I get the anti-Semitic. Let me mention one thing is that by the time this incredibly vibrant effort is going on in the 1840s and 1850s, Columbia, this is sort of extraordinary, had the highest concentration of Jews to its white citizens of any city in America. Had the highest concentration. That's part of the explanation why Jews are elected, being elected to office. They're no means here are majority, but they are a significant part of the population. They are they make up a significant number of the Jewish lawyers, of the lawyers and physicians in town, and they are certainly a major part of the business community on what was then Main Street, Richardson Street. But there are episodes, and it is not an accurate reflection of the historic record to sort of not talk about them, and I think it is worth remembering a few of these moments. One of those involved, and we may remember this from some of the folks who grew up with me, the sort of Sunday Sabbath laws that arose in the 60s, where Jews were not allowed to open their, in the 1960s, open stores on Sunday when they would close on their Sabbath. Well, that battle had been going on in Columbia since literally the 1830s. And there was a businessman by the name of Alexander Marks, remember the Marks Relish House? Well, that was his parents. Dr. Elias Marks, the educator, that was his brother. Dr. Alexander Marks was a merchant, very successful merchant. And he closed on the Sabbath, and he opened on Sunday. Well, it's Columbia's complicated racial history of that era. Slaves were given Sunday off, and they would come into town, they would gather, and they would barter their goods and sell. There was actually sort of a little bit of an underground economy, and they would do some trading with the Jewish merchants. Well, some of the city's leadership was concerned with it as a matter of security. They thought that was unsafe. And they were worried, while most of the white citizens of Columbia were in church, that somehow these African-American slaves could be a security threat. And so they banned Sunday school on sales. They closed, and Alexander Marx said that violates my right to freedom of religion. Kind of sound familiar to today's ear. And he refused to close the store. He was arrested, prosecuted, and convicted of violating the city ordinance. He was so enraged, he left town, moved to New Orleans, where he formed with his brother-in-law, a highly successful business. And by his grandson's era, they were among the wealthiest families in America, in New Orleans. And that story was told us by Dr. Jacob Rayner Marcus, who was the legendary dean of Jewish history. He was, I think, Belinda, about 101 when we met with him. Still writing then. He was at the rabbinical seminary in Cincinnati. And he told us that story about Alexander Marx leaving. We didn't know what had happened until we knew he'd been prosecuted. And Dr. Marcus tells us he goes there and they create this incredible wealth. His family is so influential. And he says, the price of intolerance, right? They left Columbia. Another story, which was very troubling, occurred in the 1840s and involved the then governor of South Carolina, Governor Hammond. Now, if anybody knows anything about Governor Hammond, he was a sort of notorious historic figure in South Carolina. And I mean to go into all the details, but he was not a good guy. And he was had a lot of people who, towards the end of his gubernatorial term, who were out to get him, so to say, including his nephew, Wade Hampton, who accused him of molesting his sisters. And they were going to kill him. Okay, they said, "We catch you, we're going to kill you." And in the middle of this sort of shocking scandal involving the governor, he issues what is called a Thanksgiving Day proclamation. Now, today we think about Thanksgiving being on Thursday in November. It wasn't a set time then, but periodically you would go and you would have this day of thanks, and the governor could proclaim it. And there was a standard proclamation in which you would encourage people to go to thank God, neutrally speaking, thank God for being allowed to for abundance in their life. So he issues a Thanksgiving Day proclamation, but insists that it includes that you should go and praise Jesus Christ. And that is very offensive to the Jewish community of Charleston, who have always been busy getting everybody else in trouble, right? And they issue a protest letter to Governor Hammond, and they say that this violates the freedom of religion, inclusion of all people. The Jewish people have always been included. And Hammond responds to that by issuing this horribly anti-Semitic statement, in which he says that they show the same scorn for me as they showed in killing Jesus. These Jews. Well, this is like this huge scandal and huge controversy. And right after all this, Hammond leaves office. And Governor Aiken takes his place. And Governor Aiken's first response, and when he comes in, the first action, is to issue a new proclamation. And a new proclamation encourages everyone to go to their place of religious a practice and to thank God. No mention of any particular faith. And with that, this great controversy seemed to be over. But the Columbia newspaper had to comment on that. And they said that Aiken had backed down to the Jews. Okay, and the truth was that William Aiken, who I believe was like the wealthiest man in South Carolina at the time, who began to go, had made business partnerships with the Jews of Charleston. He was very close to the Jewish community. M.C. Mordecai was the state senator at the time from Charleston. She was one state senator from Charleston was Jewish. And but so if you know sort of both of those stories, you know, there is this thing of there is this episode of anti-Semitism, and particularly the Hammond story, it's sort of the normal sort of returns with the issuance of that proclamation. Now, the Jewish community of Columbia was committed to the Confederate cause. It was home. The South was home. Robert Rosen has written about the Jewish Confederates. You know, it's shocking to some of us to say, how could the children of Moses defend slavery? I mean, it's a kind of fair question. And the Jews were not particularly large slave owners. I mean, Chapman Levy was the largest Jewish slave owner in America with 20 slaves. But Jews had been accepted in the South, had been accepted in South Carolina, and they were prepared to defend home. Judah Benjamin, who was the Secretary of State of the Confederacy, was obviously well-known Jewish public official. Columbia was largely untouched by the war until right near the end. It was actually kind of thrived. It had factories, Confederate factories, Confederate activities. It was not really scarred much by the war until near the end, when Sherman's march to the sea made a fake towards Charleston, leaving Columbia defenseless, and they marched right into Columbia. And Belinda has put up this scene here, which is, of course, the burning of Columbia. The Jews of Charleston, convinced that they were about to be attacked, took all the Jewish relics from KKBE and brought them to Columbia for safekeeping. And they were in the synagogue on Assembly Street when the fire broke out. And they were, and it was a devastating, it was on Shabbat Eve, and it was a devastating fire that really fundamentally destroyed much of what had been the city of Columbia, and certainly the downtown Columbia. And there was a wonderful diary by a Jewish woman named Eleanor Cohen, who documented the horrors of those days in February, on February 17th, with the burning of Columbia. And she described the fire. She said from her diary, "We gathered together in a room at the top of the house, and as we gazed, we saw new fires burst forth in every direction. The flames were seen leaping and dancing and assisted by the winds and the world work of destruction. From every heart went up to God a prayer that he would lull the wind, stay the flames, and put mercy in the heart of our foes. Vain hopes." And then she described the day after. "We were houseless, homeless, and without food or clothing. And one night we were brought from comparative wealth and luxury to abject poverty. I never imagined I should be so near actual starvation. We suffered in every human nature is capable of suffering. Want of rest, food, even water, without a change of clothing or privacy to change it in." Columbia was devastated. And in that devastation, it asked one of the great Jewish public officials of the time, M.C. Mordecai, I mentioned earlier, to come up from Charleston to lead the refugee effort. And he did that. And there were calls for in national Jewish publications for help from the other Jewish communities, to help the Jews of Columbia who were suffering so greatly. And when funds arrived, the Jews decided, instead of keeping the money in within the community, they gave it to the general effort for refugees. So they did not just keep it to themselves, but shared it with their neighbors. And they were also leaders throughout in this terrible moment in South Carolina and Columbia history. And there was an article in the local paper, a new paper called the Daily Phoenix, which was created shortly after the fire, and it said this of the Jewish efforts: "We have heard from so many sources of the handsome conduct of the Israelites of Columbia, and indeed the subject is one of such general remark that it demands our public acknowledgement. No people could have been more active in their efforts to assist the sufferers during the fire. to protect, shelter, and provide for the destitute, the women, and the children flying from burning houses. None have been more benevolent, more bounteous to the hungry and naked, more charitable in their gifts, more humane in their sympathies. We shall remember all those things. But the truth was, the fire brought to the end an era, because many of these Jewish families, as Belinda mentioned, lived in places like, came from places like Philadelphia, like Charleston, like Baltimore. And when the town was essentially a smoldering hulk of many of the, I mean, one of the wealthiest Jews owned the gas works. Can you imagine what would happen to the gas works and the fire? They left. They mostly left. And I'll let Belinda sort of finish, bring us to the current.
Well, not to the current, but the bottom line is these families left for the most part. Some of them stayed, a small number. And we all know that what happens in the 1870s and 1880s, up through the 1920s and 30s, is that we have new waves of Jewish immigration to America and to Columbia. So, as we wrap up this early piece of Columbia's Jewish history, and as Richard and I think back to 20 years ago, there were a couple of questions that we had. And as we end, I want to mention one of them. I talked a little bit about the young woman who came to Columbia in the 1840s and started the Jewish Sunday School, and whose efforts really resulted in the organization of the first formal congregation and the building of a synagogue. Her name was Boanna Wolf. Around 1848, she left Columbia and went back to Philadelphia. She married, and she and her husband had a couple of children. I knew that she came back to Columbia right before the Civil War. Remember, her sister is married to Henry Lyons. And Henry Lyons died in 1858. His widow had no children. So Boanna moves in with her sister. And Boanna has four children at the time. During the Civil War, Boanna organized the Columbia Ladies Industrial Union, which provided work for Civil War widows. A lot of it was handiwork, but they contacted friends even during the war who were in places like Philadelphia to say, can you please help these ladies out? After the war, this organization continues, and then Boanna opens a school in Columbia that is well known and that educates many young men. So the bottom line is that we knew Boanna had come back, but we never were able to find a picture of her. And I knew there had to be one. I'm that loud. We knew there had to be one somewhere. We looked hard, couldn't find it. I couldn't even find any descendants of Boanna Wolf. And I am good at research. So I'm playing around, and remember, this is sort of pre-internet genealogy, but I'm going through documents trying to find someone that can say what happened to at least the children, but again, hoping there could be some connection. And then 2 years ago, Alan Ryan sends me an email and says, I'm here with descendants of Boanna Wolf in Columbia at the Dreher High School reunion. And I will tell you, I was stunned. Absolutely stunned. And I am thrilled that we have with us today. And they've come back from Massachusetts. Some are living in Lexington, South Carolina. the descendants of Boanna Wolf, and I would ask at this point if you would mind standing. And let us tell you how happy we are you're with us, okay? Thank you. Any questions or comments? Parting thoughts?
So how did you find them?
Alan Ryan. They came back. So, Francis, tell us how you hooked up.
Well, I have been doing my own genealogy research and trying to find out.
Stand up, please, so we can hear you better.
Trying to find out the origins of my great grandmother, who was in Richmond, Virginia, and discovered on my aunt's wonderful newspaper announcement that she was the son, daughter of a Dr. Albert Mordecai. And so I think, well, who is this Dr. Albert Mordecai? And I'm thinking it's Mordecai's in Richmond. But this was in Columbia. And so obviously the people of Columbia, when my aunt married in 1930s, knew of this relationship. So I'm researching and I finally find the family and I finally find a lot of the Jewish genealogies that trace the family back. And so I'm going on the web and I find out about Boanna Wolf, and then I come across the mention. I think when Google was, you know, scanning all those books, I may have scanned one of them. And so I'm trying to find this history of the synagogue here in Columbia. And I discovered that Alan Reiner, who had been my father's lawyer here in Columbia, his estate lawyer, that Alan was one of the sponsors. So I called up Alan and said, Alan, how can I get a hot copy of this book? And so I was coming for my high school reunion. And so I met up with Alan, and he gave us three copies of the book that he had at his house. And I was just so pleased. And then he gave me Belinda's contact information.
We haven't found an image yet, but we're still looking. We think it may be in Philadelphia. So. But it's great to have you here with us. Thank you so much. Great to be back in Columbia with you.